Good afternoon. Welcome back after some time for many of you. We've had a break for a month, and as you can see, I'm all wired up. I have like two things here, and all these wires inside me. So
it's not why you have to start with welcome again.
So, okay, sorry. Why is that?
You're going to say welcome again.
Welcome again?
Yes.
Okay. Oh, because of the video. Oh, sorry. Yes. So I have to perform today. See, I can't be natural. I'll just be natural. But welcome again. We'll begin with some meditation. Can we have some music? Some?
Yes, okay now.
Thanks. Letting go of all thoughts of the past. All apprehensions of the future. I bring my mind to rest in the present moment. Sitting here on this chair. Withdrawing myself from all thoughts of this external physical reality. I turn my attention inwards. Going deep within to the center of my existence. I experience my entire existence merging, converging, concentrating into a point in the center of the brain. Experience myself as just a point of consciousness. The source of all life. The soul. That energy which was before this body was. That which will be after this body is no more. Just a speck of consciousness. Sparkling like a star in the center of the brain. I listen to the deep silence within. The comforting silence of the spirit. The deep comforting stillness of being. stabilized in this awareness. Of my spiritual self. I go beyond the limits of this physical body and this physical world. Beyond the limits of the earth, the moon, the sun, the stars. Beyond all the limits of space and time. Till I see myself in the world of light. A world of silence. In the presence of the Supreme. A point source of infinite peace. Blissful silence. A silence that is full to beings of light, in deep, silent communion. This experience of deep silence and this light, I allow myself to return back to this world of matter, back to this room, back to this body, this physical costume of mine. Once again find myself seated in the center of the brain, spreading the light of life throughout the brain and the body. I, the eternal spirit within, the being of peace. Om Shanti. Okay. So as Sonia mentioned, this month is dedicated to the environment. What does the environment, or what does spirituality have to do with the environment? So, in the Brahma Kumari's Environment Initiative, they speak about consciousness and climate change. Consciousness and climate change. Sonia spoke a little bit about awareness and attitudes. How behind our behavior lie certain attitudes, and those attitudes emerge from a certain awareness, and in this way they are connected. Meditation is often spoken about as a way of transforming our awareness and thereby our attitude and thereby our behavior. Today we will try and look at it also psychologically. There is a field of psychology called environmental psychology. Many of you may be aware of that. Trying to study the impact the natural environment has on the human mind and the impact the human mind has on the natural environment. It's a very interesting field of research. There is a historian called Turner. He spoke a lot about how the environment shapes human personality, how the environment sometimes shapes culture. Environment has a huge impact on the mind. And the mind also has a huge impact on the environment in many ways. Winston Churchill used to say, we shape our environments and our environments shape us. What we create then shape us. Right? I recently attended a talk on design, architecture. Design for wellness. It was a very interesting talk. Design for wellness. They have a consulting company, I forget the name, and they engage with health providers, hospitals, and PLIEM, the community agencies that take care of the elderly. And she was speaking about research now that tells us how the colors that we have on the walls influence recovery of patients. How the art you have in a hospital influences the amount of time people take to recover from an illness. The kind of music people listen to, it's amazing. The influence these things have on the mind. And they try and use this evidence-based practice in designing hospitals, for example, that are more supportive of recovery, that create an environment that is more conducive for people to recover and heal. So the environment has significant influence. There is interesting research happening in that area now. Turner used to say that the way a personality of a culture is, personality is the individual self, right? But then culture is like the personality of a group. And he has this theory about how the natural environment shapes the culture of a people, personality of a group of people. And he spoke about the United States of America. I was there for the past 2 weeks, so I'm speaking about that now. But he speaks about this, how the existence of the frontier, this vast open expanse of land and resources that these immigrants who came from different parts of the world into the US, they had to face. The huge expanse of land and resources. And to survive, to succeed, they had to go out into this frontier, be adventurous, and learn how to use what they have in this vast expanse of land to develop a society. And he says that's what developed this enterprising personality that you see, of course, in the United States. Outgoing, enterprising, open to many things like that. More recently, people compared people in the United States to people in the northern part of Japan. Now, why is that? Because the northern part of Japan is also a sort of a frontier which is very challenging. It's not very inhabitable. The people who went there to populate that part of Japan had to face significant challenges because nature was tough. There was nothing established there. And the people who went there were the samurai. They populated that region of Japan, the northern part of Japan. So they had the same similar experience of a frontier that they had to go and deal with. They had to bring it into their control in various ways. And then some psychologists compared the personality and the value system of people in the United States with people living in northern Japan. Very interestingly, they found that the people in northern Japan had much more similarity with the people in the United States than with the people in Japan. Very interesting, because of the nature of the environment that they were exposed to, that they had to deal with, very similar to the kind of environment they had to deal with there. So we see it's very interesting and fascinating, the influence of the environment on the way we think, on our value system, etc. And then we also have our own influence on the environment. How do we shape our environments? And of course, what is the impact of the various ways in which we deal with the environment? Climate change has been an issue for a long time, we know that. It's one of the most popular topics in the world these days. Everybody is speaking about it. And the critiques say that's all they're doing, they're just speaking about it. There's not much else that is happening. We have all these big events every year, billions and billions of dollars and euros is spent on these events. Various countries come together, they sit, they negotiate, they try to bring down CO2 emissions around the world. Not much seems to be happening. Not much seems to be happening. People go back and it's really back to square one. Why is that? And we recognize the seriousness of the issue now. Now more than ever, for the past one decade, humanity has begun to recognize the very serious nature of this issue. Scientists are speaking about us being on the brink of a huge natural calamity. So many movies are being made about this, right, these days. Recently a movie came out called Noah. I want to see that. I don't know if some of you have seen it. But it's about this change, yeah? And how nature also responds, nature reacts to the way we have been treating our environment. And yet, not much seems to be happening. We seem to be slipping back into our old ways of doing things. We're shaken up when something happens, and then we slip back into the old ways of doing things. This sort of reminds me of what happened in the world, mainly in the western part of the world, but also, of course, in eastern, like, for example, in Japan, during the First World War and the Second World War. We had the First World War. After the First World War, all the nations, the powerful nations of the world who had the military and economic power, they came together and they said, we cannot afford to have another war like that. And then they formed the League of Nations. Right? And then you had the Second World War. So the League of Nations was formed to prevent the occurrence of any such war. And then you had the Second World War, which was even worse than the First World War. The League of Nations failed. After the Second World War, all these nations came together again and said, we cannot afford to have another war like that, and they formed the United Nations. And we are seeing even today so much conflict in the world, so many wars all over the place. It's like humanity wants to stop war, but is unable to stop war. It's like you want to stop it, but you don't want to stop it. Because if you really wanted to stop it, why is it that we have it? It's a little bit like that with climate change. We want to change, but we don't want to change. There's something inside, some sort of a conflict, some sort of competing interests operating inside the human being, inside the human mind, perhaps at a very deep unconscious level, where we go against our own interests. We understand, we recognize we have to change, and yet we don't change. We keep slipping back into old patterns. This, to me at least, indicates there are some very deep, very, very deep issues that we have to deal with. We can speak about let's share, sharing Copenhagen. We can distribute flyers and pamphlets. People can sit and talk about it. But change is something else. Change requires something very, 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 very deep. Are we willing to change? That's the question. and what does it require for us to change? We will try and speak about some of these things today. So, living simply and being unlimited. Nice to say, that's the website for the talks. Anything else behind that? No, nothing else here. So, let me go back to environmental psychology. People have been trying to study the human beings' relationship to the environment. And very interestingly, some researchers have come up with a model. They've tried to look at how the relationship between the environment, the natural environment, and humanity has sort of progressed over time. Interesting, right? They have a research model that they work with. And they try and reduce it down to three patterns in the relationships human beings have had with the environment. The first is what is referred to as the experience of submission to natural forces, servitude. Nature is too powerful, there's not much we can do about it. And this is probably a theme, we can find this theme even now, but this is probably a theme that was quite prevalent in the olden days, maybe, you know, a couple of thousand years ago, when we didn't have much technology and people were pretty much exposed to the vagaries of nature. And we know because of that, people also started giving a form to various elements of nature and then worshipping paganism, right? So there is the ocean god, because you feel powerless in front of the ocean. Ocean just comes in, and then you lose all these things that you have around you that give you a sense of security, your family, your belonging. So you have a fire god, you have an ocean god, you have the air god, you have all these gods and goddesses that were supposedly controlling nature, right? In the Nordic countries also we have these gods and goddesses. We have Thor, or Thor as you would say, I think, the controlling thunder and rain and many other gods and goddesses. You find this pretty common pattern all across the world, from India to Egypt to even ancient Arabia. And then, of course, in ancient Europe, you had this trend. This understanding that we are sort of weak in front of nature and this experience of a submission to nature. So trying to appease nature and natural elements so that they can take care of us in that way. And then, in time, people moved from this to, you could say, the experience of a striving for mastery. I want to achieve mastery over the environment. I want to control. I want to bring it under control. So I plant, I use land, I cultivate the land. I try and control. I try and build dikes so that the ocean doesn't come in. I try and reclaim land from the sea and build things on that. In some way, I'm trying to harness the forces of nature and trying to develop mastery over nature so that I have some sense of control and I can also use the resources the natural environment offers me. But along with this experience of mastery, we also then move on to the experience of exploitation, manipulation of the world around me, where in some ways we even start abusing nature. That's something which has become perhaps more prevalent in recent times, past couple of hundred years perhaps, when we have had technology. With the Industrial Revolution, things started, we started developing goods and products and many things like that. A certain exploitation of nature, you reclaim land from the sea, you use natural resources, but then in a way that is harmful to the environment. Many things started emerging, and we have this experience of exploitation. As we start exploiting nature, we have, of course, the experience of natural disasters more and more, and we have seen this now. The scale and frequency of natural disasters has been increasing, that's quite clear. And has become more and more clear over the past couple of decades. That again returns us to this experience of submission, servitude to nature, beyond a point we can't really control. And so people say, we need to now move to an experience of living in harmony with nature. What does it take to live in harmony with nature? And that's a big question. So all this stuff about green technology, clean technology, it's about developing a sense of harmony with nature. And the in environmental psychology, we say that it's not that these things have been through history in this particular way. Yes, earlier it was more submission and then a sense of mastery. Now we're moving towards harmony. But throughout, we've always had pockets of civilization where people have lived more in harmony than other pockets of civilization. Even now, I'm sure you would find many places in the world where people are much more in harmony with nature. They live in more environment-friendly ways than in other parts of the world. So one is through history, we find certain emphases over time, but also across, at the same, in the same period of time, across the world, we find different emphases in different places. So anyway, the question for us is, how do we move towards, genuinely move towards, not just speaking about it, but genuinely move towards living in harmony with nature? What does it require? And what does spirituality have to say about this? So let's go back to exploitation first, manipulation. Exploitation, manipulation of nature. And we know that it is even against our objectivity. I mean, if you look at it objectively, it doesn't make sense. We are harming ourselves. We are creating a future, or we may not even have a future really, that we'll be, you know, we are in a situation like that. We know that, and yet we are unable to stop ourselves. Why do you think that is? We sit, we plan, we think, we talk. Lots of research happening, and we keep slipping back into old patterns. Some countries tell other countries, oh, you have to do something to bring down your CO2 emissions. And these countries turn around to these countries and say, ah, you made your money by exploiting nature, now it's our turn. And you want to stop us now, but we want to make our money. What answer do you give to them? Yeah, you make your money, but you destroy the world. They say, yeah, but you destroyed the world now. It's so difficult, right? Why do you think we are in this situation where objectively we know this is not right, and yet we give in to that pattern again and again, deepening the crisis in the world? Why? What is underlying this manipulation, exploitation of our natural environment? Why do we want to do that? What do you think? Yes?
Because maybe we still feel like separated from it. We don't feel combined with the nature and the universe around us.
Mm.
Because we want to be individuals and so on.
Mm-hmm. We feel separated, and therefore, but we know this is not good for us. Why do we give in again and again? It's against our self-interests. What is controlling us? Yes?
It must be some other values that we perceive more important.
What is it that we perceive more important?
Luxury. Like
luxury. Why do we perceive that luxury is so much more important when it is actually against our own long-term self? Interest. You were saying something? Yeah, go on. Yes.
I think it's because we act the unconscious.
Yeah. What is it that is making us act in that unconscious manner, in that compulsive manner? Yes, you were saying something?
Because we get our identity through material stuff.
We get our identity through material stuff. Anything else? In ancient Christian theology, not so ancient, but anyway, in Christian theology, they speak of the seven deadly sins, right? Yeah. One of these seven deadly sins is greed. Mm. And when people give in to greed, objectivity just goes away. We know that. So it's not so fashionable to speak about sins anymore, right? But when we see it practically, this is greed in play. People want more and more and more and more. They just cannot stop. And as you said, something about values, our greed, this complete centeredness on my own want, what I want, what I desire, this egocentrism, completely focused on my want and desire, that makes me greedy. I want to possess. And it's a great tool of, it's a great political tool, because the way you stay in power sometimes is to feed the greed of people. And if you don't feed the greed of people, you will not be in power. So even for political parties, it's a practical, but if I want to do good for the world, I have to be in power. And if I have to be in power, then I have to satisfy people in some way. And if people want to satisfy their own needs in certain ways, then I have to find ways of doing that so that I can be in power, and then I can do something good. But you start feeding those needs, and that leads to a situation which is not very healthy. Denmark has done so much for the environment. Copenhagen is one of the most livable cities in the world, perhaps the most livable city in the world. Clean tech, green technology. But you know, Denmark has one of the highest, if not the highest, certainly one of the highest private debt in the world. Private debt, not public debt. There, Denmark is very strong, but private debt. Why do people want so much money and take loans and then do what? And you find this in the world. Many countries have a huge public debt. People want more and more. And we have to find ways of feeding, giving people more and more. What to do? Meditate. How will that solve the problem? Does it solve the problem? Of course, the reason why we are here is we are saying, yes, it solves the problem. Sit and meditate, everything becomes okay. Does it really work that way? It's very deep, right? It's very, very deep. Change is very deep, and change is very, very difficult. It requires a very deep awareness. But where does this desire come from? This greed, a manifestation of our desire, going by wants rather than according to our needs. Where does desire come from? Yes.
The ego.
What about the ego?
It makes desires.
Yes, but why? That, what is the connection between the ego and desire? Yes, you were saying something.
I think it's because of lack of something else. What you really need, you don't even know what it is, and you can't get it. And then you try to fill it in other ways.
There is a lack of attainment inside, and what you speak about as the ego, we understand both psychologically and spiritually, the ego is a construction that emerges because of the lack of attainment. I need to hold on to something. There is a sense of lack of attainment inside. And that, we don't like this feeling of emptiness, right? Lack of attainment, emptiness. I want to hold on to something. And that leads to the construction of what you spoke about as identity. Our identity, you said, is tied so much to these physical things. We come into limits. Because we believe deep inside these limits are giving us something. This desire coming from a lack of attainment, in other words, you could speak about it as some sense of emptiness. And then it gives birth to desire, this sense of lack of attainment. But along with this lack of, because of this lack of attainment, I also want to sort of hold on to something. And then we have this experience of the attachment to various forms of identity. Firstly, the identity of this physical body. And the moment I identify with something that has limits, this physical body also has limits. It will not live forever. The moment I identify with this physical body, I am associating my existence with mortality. I am associating my existence with finiteness. And the moment I experience myself to be finite, limited, and mortal, there is the experience of insecurity. And the experience of insecurity makes me hold on to something or the other to make myself feel secure. The body, I believe, is one way that I have some sense of definition of myself. It could be culture. It could be religion. It could be certain experiences I have had in the past. I hold on to something, certain limited identities, because I believe that will give me some sense of attainment. The inner emptiness creates desire, it also creates attachment. And in a lot of spiritual philosophies around the world, the two roots of suffering, one desire, the other is attachment. Desire and attachment. Attachment creates insecurity. Desire comes from emptiness. And then that manifests as greed. Then we give in to things that we know are against our own self-interests, because we believe in some way that will fill us up, that will give us some lack of attainment. Look at an alcoholic. The alcoholic recognizes alcohol is not good for me. And yet, he or she finds himself or herself at the place where you have alcohol. And you give in to that pattern again and again. A deep inner emptiness. And so we can sit and speak about values, we can sit and speak about, we can have all these international negotiations all over the world around climate change, how to bring down CO2 levels and all that, but if that basic inner lack of attainment, basic inner emptiness of the human being, if that is not addressed, whatever we do, we will probably not be able to make any sustainable change. And this is where spirituality comes in. How do you have the experience of attainment? Because then the key is, I need the experience of attainment. I need the inner experience of some fullness that will give me a sense of satisfaction. And from there I can move on. Otherwise, we go against our self-interest. I'll give you a very interesting example of a company. It's a company. Right? Now this company, well, I don't know how environment friendly it is, but the company used to actually deal with brewing and selling beer. Right? This was a European company. It used to brew and sell beer. So it had a long chain and it used to make its own beer. It had its own supply chain. It had its own farms where they grew the stuff that they needed to make, to put in the beer. And then they had their own chain, retail chain. They had their own pubs and they would sell the beer. So very old company, around for more than 100 years. A few decades ago, they sat down, they did their market research, and they found out that the number of people who will drink beer is going to go down. Because white-collar jobs are going up, blue-collar jobs are going down. Typically, the kind of people who drink beer are blue-collar workers, and that's going down. So we need to look at an alternative. If we are to survive as an organization, we need to look at an alternative to our business. So they did their own strategy rethink, and they decided, okay, let us move into something else. Let's move into hospitality, hotels, leisure. And they made a strategy around that. They acquired some brands, hotel brands, and they were in this process. And in the middle of this process, suddenly they were exposed to an opportunity where they could buy more than some 200 pubs belonging to another chain. And they said, okay, let's go for this. Let's acquire all these pubs. And they went into that deal. The market was very confused. Everybody outside was thinking, hey, what's wrong with these guys? They just decided to bring about a change in their strategy. And now they want to get out of the beer business. And now they want to buy another beer business. Why is that? The company's stocks fell. It was a major crisis. They came out of it later. And you find this pattern pretty consistent in many, many organizations. You realize this is not right for me. I need to go here. And yet, you start doing that. We recognize that from our own lives, right, sometimes? You make a plan, now this doesn't work for me, I need to be doing this. And then we end up doing more of this. And we sabotage our own self-interest. Why does that happen? So like right now we know the world, climate change, it's a major issue. We need to work with more environment-friendly things. We need to live our lives differently. We make plans, and then we go back to the old pattern, old way of doing things. Why does that happen? Yeah? Why does that happen? Yes?
We feel we are in a hurry.
We feel we are in a hurry. Why? But we know that's not going to work for us, and yet we fall back. Why is that?
Subconsciously.
Why? Why?
Programming.
Programming. You were saying something?
We are afraid of the unseen.
Even though we know the present scene is not very good, we'd rather hold on to that than actually make a change. The faith in the malproductive patterns is so deep because we get some sense of temporary attainment through these malproductive patterns. Some sense of attainment. I have a friend here in Copenhagen. She's a psychologist. She works with people who have had difficulties with, you know, substance abuse and all that. And she goes to the job center and she works with these people, trying to help them to get jobs, try to change, you know, positive thinking. She tries to go and teach them ways of positive thinking. So she was saying one of these girls, long history of drug abuse, and she was carrying out this little intervention on positive thinking. And this girl said, "I don't want to think positive." And she asked, "But why? Is it working for you the way you think right now? All this negativity, is it working for you?" She said, "No, not really." "Then why don't you want to change?" And she said something very interesting and very deep. She says, "But this is the only thing I know. I don't know what that would be like. This is the only thing I know. And therefore I want to hold on to that." See how deep our inner experience, here we're going into the level, into the domain of feelings. A level of intellectual analysis and understanding can help us to a certain extent. But we go into the domain of feelings, and feelings are connected to faith. It is not a very rational process. Our feelings are connected to faith. Faith has been established that whatever this is probably the only thing I know. This is what makes me feel secure. Getting out of this, I don't know what it is like. I'd rather stay back with that because at least there, I'm having some level of attainment. So I know this physical body will finish one day. Intellectually, I know that. But I have no other way of feeling secure. Culture, my identification with culture, as long as I'm in that culture, it's fine. The moment I'm exposed to something different, there is a feeling of threat. I feel insecure. But that's the only thing I know. I feel secure only by that. Deep inside, that's how I feel secure. I want to hold on to that. Deep experiences of faith. And therefore, we say intellectually, if I want to move away from this attachment to the identity which is limited, which includes the body, which includes things like relationships, for example, which includes things like my culture and religion and race and ethnicity. You know something? There is some fascinating, it's so interesting time for psychology, fascinating research emerging. Race, gender identity, how limiting it is. It's amazing. I'll give you some of this research. This was carried out at Stanford, on students at Stanford. Now, Stanford is one of the best universities in the world. So any student who's got admission into Stanford obviously has certain potential, right? And they carried out this research at Stanford in many ways. One was men and women, gender identity, right? Male, female, gender identity. Very simple. They give men and women, and all are very highly qualified, very competent people, they give them an examination on some subject, whatever it may be. So they have control group and experimental group. So control group, men, women, randomly distributed. Experimental group, men, women, randomly distributed. In the experimental group, before they take the exam, they are asked on a piece of paper to tick their gender. That's it. In the other group, they are not given that priming. It's called priming. Because the moment you ask a person to tick whether you're male or female, you're thinking, who am I? Oh, I'm male. I'm female. Right? It's a priming. You know what happened? Just that one little experimental intervention. The men performed better than the women in this group. The men and women were similar in performance in this group. Because of the various experiences and stereotypes associated with gender identity. Academics, man's domain and this is not the woman's domain. Deep things, you may not even believe in that. You ask these women, do you believe that women perform lesser than men in academics? They would say, no, of course not. They're strong women. But when they are primed, something else comes up. Fascinating, isn't it? How gender identity can be limiting. We go against our own self-interest. And then they carried out this experiment on many, many fronts. African-American and European-American students at Stanford, so no difference in their level of capability, right? Before an athletic performance, for a similar level of capability, again, they're just primed, they're asked, experimental group, control group, asked to tick their ethnicity, European-American or African-American. The African-Americans perform better in athletics than the European-Americans. And the European-Americans perform better in mathematics than the African-Americans. In reality, there was no difference in their potential. You see, race, ethnicity, another limitation. And when our identity is invested in these limited identities, automatically there is this sense of inner insecurity. We may not even be able to understand that because these things are very, very deep, existential. Very deep. This feeling of insecurity upon which the ego is built. Ego is identity, right? Ego is I. Ego is Latin for I. That is the identity. Where is my identity invested? Gender, race, culture. And the moment I do that, there is a sense of limitation. There is a sense, there is a feeling of insecurity. And then I hold on to this. And then I try and fill up this emptiness, this insecurity I feel in some other ways. And then so countries stand up and speak about national interests. What about the interest of the other country? We do things in our national interest. Yes? Identity, national identity. What about the others? No, it doesn't matter. We have to take care of our national interests. This is the divided world. And so the deeper question is, until the world remains divided like this, on limited boundaries of nation, ethnicity, culture, religion, language, gender, and if we hold on to these divisions in our mind, will we ever be able to go ahead and overcome this emptiness that is needed? Insecurity, first of all, overcome insecurity. Overcome emptiness that is needed to overcome greed, that is needed to move from this experience of relationship with nature of exploitation, manipulation, abuse, which goes against our own self-interest. Will we be able to go beyond that? This is a deeper question. The Brahma Kumari's Environment Initiative tries to address that question by explaining how important it is for us to move beyond this limited identity into the experience of the unlimited. Now, this is an experience. This is not an intellectual exercise. This cannot be an intellectual exercise. That's what people do in all these conferences. This has to be an experience of moving into the unlimited, because only that experience will deepen the faith. The faith that I can feel secure without identifying with gender and race and religion and culture and ethnicity, nation, I can actually feel secure. And that is the experience of the unlimited. When we speak about the soul, we speak about God. These are the two central concepts in Raja Yoga, soul and God. This is not from the traditional theological religious understanding of, you know, someone up there who is going to judge us and punish us. It's not about that. It's about moving into the unlimited. It's about moving into an experience of relation with the Supreme. And relatedness is a fundamental human need. We know that. If it is not satisfied, people develop all sorts of problems. We know, for example, psychologically, children who have not experienced loving, secure relationships with their caregivers when they were young frequently develop problems. Very often they develop eating disorders, overeating, they put on weight, they're trying to fill up that inner lack of attainment through something physical, sweet, food, reminds you of love. We know that. Relatedness is very, very important. At the same time, when this experience of relatedness is
limited to a form, to a particular relationship, or to few relationships, there will always be insecurity, because that is mortal. That will finish at some point. And therefore, the logic of developing a relationship with the Supreme, because that is eternal. There is no mortality. There is no finiteness in that. I move into that relationship, I move into the unlimited. I move into the experience of being pure consciousness. There is no limit to consciousness. That's the soul. Pure consciousness. I move into the experience of the unlimited. And when I experience that unlimitedness of the spirit, pure consciousness, the unlimitedness of the relationship with the Supreme, when I experience it, when I allow myself to experience it over a period of time, I will experience the sense of fullness, or we can call it a sense of inner attainment. And when I experience this inner attainment, I will not work from the space of wants and desires, then I will work from the space of what I need. Because the experience of security and fullness that I wanted, I am getting it from the experience of moving into the unlimited. Then I have objectivity. Here I lose objectivity because of greed. When I'm focused on what I need, I work with objectivity. And when I can work with objectivity, I can live simply. Simplicity follows. I can be in harmony with nature. But that's the long way and the connection with our relationship. If we want to be in harmony with nature, I need to move to a state where I am working in balance. And balance is simplicity. That I don't need much. I know what I need. What I need, the world has enough for all of us, what we need. The world will never have enough for what we want. That will never happen. But the world has enough for what we need. If you look at the world now, in so many countries, food is being thrown out, wasted. In so many countries, people are going hungry. It's a very strange way the economics of the world function. Governments, nations deliberately burn their food. But that's the way the economy functions. If they don't, there is an abundance of food, prices go down, it affects the economy. And yet in other countries, people are going hungry, people are starving to death. National interests. This is the way we are functioning. And so we sit and talk about all these things, unless and until we are serious about going beyond the limits of national interests. Or national interest is just a manifestation of our inner focus on the ego, egocentric self-interest. We create the world around us. The nations, the governments are a manifestation of what we are. We as a people, as a human race, we as humanity, we are unable to go beyond our own self-interest, our limited ego interests. How can we blame others for not going beyond national interests? That is a clear, logical, direct manifestation of what I feel even say. Yes?
But majority of people are not even aware of this, but they are dismissed duality, sexism, racism, and because it's so deeply rooted over so many lifetimes, then it takes at least half of the time to change it, I think.
Yes, you're right.
On the way of it.
Majority of the people are not aware, or perhaps they don't want to make the effort to be aware. I don't know. But that's a reality and that's a challenge. That is why we are looking at a pretty serious scenario. And if we are to be serious about doing something for the world, there's a lot of work that needs to be done, and a lot of this work is very internal, very deep. But you know what? I can start at my level. Sonia spoke a little bit about simple things that we could do. I can begin at my own level. Why do I believe I need certain kinds of clothes or certain kinds of food? Why? I don't. That is what I want. What I need is pretty simple. Can I bring about a change at that level in my life? I can begin from there. And then, as people observe us, they may get inspired to bring about a change in their lives. But that's what we can do. But that's the challenge of change. And if we are to bring about a change in the way we deal with nature, if we are to move to a state of being where humanity, the human race, lives in harmony with nature, the human beings then will have to do this inner work of moving into the unlimited. Because unless and until I have that experience of safety and security inside that I can have through this process, the spiritual process of moving towards the unlimited, it is very difficult. I'll make plans. It's like New Year resolutions, right? We make these resolutions and then we go back against them. So we'll make these plans, we will go back. I've seen in my own life, right? Many times I plan change and then I slip back into old patterns and I recognize why is that happening? Because the experience of inner attainment is not there. It's not strong enough. It's very simple. Then I can sit and work on creating that sense of inner attainment. And I've seen that. Giving time for yourself every day to go into the unlimited, and this is the process of meditation. Going into the unlimited, there is a deliberate and clear process behind that. Sitting down, going into solitude, going into silence, this is going into the unlimited. One is this experience of solitude. And solitude here does not mean physical silence. It's good to have physical silence, that's a different story. Solitude here means absolute stillness of the mind. That's the work we need to do. Absolute stillness of the mind. All thoughts cease. Not all thoughts, because thoughts cannot cease. But all the unnecessary thoughts cease, and I am stabilized in that single thought, that thought focused on my unlimited experience of the self as pure consciousness. And then I go into the eternal relatedness. Relatedness with myself as a soul, relatedness with God. I move into that experience of relatedness. I stay in that experience of relatedness. The more I allow myself this experience, the deeper that faith will become. That I can have this inner attainment. I don't need to go into the limitations of identity, various forms of identity, to try to get some attainment from that. I will get some temporary attainment, but there will always be insecurity because there are limits to that. But I need to allow this. In myself, you know what? It's work. But I have actually seen, for me to move into that experience and sustain that, at least in my case, it may be different for different people, in my case, I need 4 hours of meditation every day. I have measured it, I have seen it. When it falls below 4 hours, I'm able to manage. It's not quite the same. Less than 2 hours, disaster. Well, that's a lot. But that's how it is. For anything, you need practice. You know, there is research on that. You know, the 10,000 hours rule. Have you heard of that? It's a controversial bit of research, but it's interesting research anyway. It comes actually from a Scandinavian researcher who lives and works in the US. He spoke of how people who've reached very high achievement in their own fields, musicians, chess players, various people like that, they put in hours and hours of practice every day, consistently, over 10, 20 years. That's what leads to that success. Not talent alone. There are people who are more talented. They don't reach that level of accomplishment. People may be slightly lesser talented, but because they are committed and they engage in that practice deliberately every day. So another author converted this research into the 10,000 hours rule. Then he says, if you want to be an expert in any field, you need to invest 10,000 hours of practice. Right? But I don't know if it's 10,000 or 9,992.5. That's a different story. But the essence of the story is we need to invest time in the practice of something that we recognize is important to us. Now, 4 hours is a lot, right? But I'm sure we can begin with 1 hour. Move up to 2 hours. 2 hours, I think, for the world in which we live in, 2 hours is minimum dosage. And doesn't mean you do it at a stretch. That's a bit much, right? It doesn't work like that. But break it up. Half an hour in the morning, half an hour mid-morning, half an hour in the evening, half an hour in the night, something like that. Every hour a little bit. But this practice of going within, going beyond, connecting to God, staying in the experience of the unlimited, deepening that experience of that safety and comfort and security and love that one has in the experience of the unlimited. And then returning and doing whatever we need to do. We require work. Yes?
Do you practice in stillness for us, or do you practice
Ideally, it should be a consciousness we should be able to carry with us throughout the day in all our activities. But because practically that is not possible all the time, taking out time. Now, I hope I'm not scaring you. That doesn't mean you have to now sit for 4 hours every day. Again, as I said, that's something I have discovered for myself. And I'm unable to maintain that because you get busy with so many things in the world, you lose track. But I can see that very clearly. As I start losing track of, you know, my experience of the inner self and my connectedness with God, as I start losing track, I can see, I start getting pulled by these limitations more and more. For me, it's, you know, my work, my career, my job, that's been my major trap. So I sort of start getting trapped there more and more. And then you can find that dissatisfaction coming up. There is satisfaction and there is dissatisfaction. There is satisfaction when you accomplish, but there is dissatisfaction which makes you want to accomplish more. And then there is the stress, that pressure that comes from that. And I have to work at extracting myself out of that situation. So for me, that's my story. But for many others, people may not need 4 hours, maybe 2 hours is very good for many people, I don't know. That's something we have to experiment with ourselves and find out. But the bottom line basically being, I need to figure out how much do I need, and then I need to give myself that. I need to find ways of giving myself that space, that time, to go into the experience of the unlimited. And then from that experience of fullness, things change. The way we operate in the world, the way we look at things, the way your creativity comes out. You know what? I'll give you a secret from my life. The first time, many, many years ago, two and a half years after I had started practicing Raja Yoga, I wasn't seeing the change I wanted to see. I was not experiencing that sense of deep attainment and fullness that I should experience through a spiritual life. Nothing was happening. I was pretty much empty the way I was before. A little bit, few drops thrown in here and there, but, you know, not enough. And I made this plan of doing this four-hour business for a month. I did that for a month. So that was very interesting and very, very powerful. But something very amazing happened after that. I started writing poetry. I could never write poetry before. Never, ever. I used to have a friend who was a poet. I used to be very jealous of her. She used to write beautiful poetry. And I used to say, I should write poetry. And I would sit down with a pen, yeah, like one line, and then I wouldn't know how to proceed. Something just unlocked within me. One day after that, someone told me, someone's coming down, why don't you write a song for welcoming them? I said, what? Write a song? Do it. I said, okay. I sat down. The song came out. I even sang it. And then after that, it became very easy. I could just sit down and write poetry. There is great potential within the human spirit. But we need to give time to nourish it for that potential to be unlocked. This is respect for the self. Otherwise, we give in to these limited things in the world, we actually lose respect for the self. Because we are making ourselves subservient on the attainments and accomplishments and feeling good and then wanting more and losing control, losing balance, losing stability. So, if we want nature to treat us well, we have to treat it well. But for us to treat nature well, I have to first treat myself well. And to treat myself well, I have to give time to myself to move into the unlimited again and again, deepen that experience, deepen the faith. And then I won't have to struggle with greed. I won't have to struggle with changing things. I will automatically experience the strength and power to change things. This is moving from a positive, constructive angle by deepening the experience I need to have to move forward in a harmonious way. Yes? Would you like to ask anything? No?
How does that song go?
I'm sorry, what was that? How does that song go? Oh, I've even forgotten that now. I have it written somewhere. But I was so proud of that. I remember the first time I got my computer, I wrote that down and it's on my computer. But I was so proud. It's there somewhere. I've really forgotten that. But I remember I wrote a very nice poem after that and some other poems after that. Very nice. Now I have not written for a long time, so something is probably not right. So I should probably get back to that. But anyway. So this is where we try and bring in spirituality as pretty important, not just important, but quintessential for supporting a more harmonious relationship with nature. Bo?
I was curious about the Stanford experiment. Yeah. About priming. Do you remember from the experiment whether the men in the experimental group performed better than the men in the control group?
I will need to look it up. I will need to look it up. Okay, across the groups, yeah. What I know is there was no significant difference here and there was a significant difference there. But was there a difference between this and that? That's something I don't remember. I will look it up. Interesting bit of research. Yes?
I would like to maybe talk a bit more about the image of God in the sense that the image I was brought up with was connected to religion. So I have to sort of find a way of, in prayers, for instance, who am I addressing? It's a sort of question that I try not to put any image on it, but
yes.
It comes back again and again. I've got these old associations with God, you know, from religion. So I need in some way to clear it.
Yeah. I will just clarify that question for you. Okay. So I have to start exactly there. This reminds me of my acting days. I used to be an actor, you know. So I did stuff for theater and I also did stuff for television. And we used to have these shootings. And there, of course, very uncomfortable because I need to have all that paint and all that stuff. So, are we ready? Ready to roll? Lights, camera, action, as I say. So, action. Yes, so she was speaking about this image of God. What is the understanding of God that we use in Raja Yoga? And it is very true that many of us, when we speak about God, our understanding is heavily colored by religion and religious understanding and teachings and various religious backgrounds. And we have different religious backgrounds, so it is colored by differences in many ways. In Raja Yoga, one of the inspiration behind this whole movement, Brahma Kumaris, and the teaching of Raja Yoga, was to create a platform and to create an understanding of concepts like soul and God that people from different walks of life, different religious and cultural backgrounds should be able to identify with easily. So when we refer to God, we are just referring to that being. It's a being of light, it's energy, there is no physical form to that being. Just as we say consciousness, can you give a form to consciousness? It's awareness, it's pure consciousness. You represent it, we say, point of light, but it's not like a point like that. It's energy concentrated to infinity, there is no end to infinity. Similarly, we say the soul, consciousness, is infinity. God is also consciousness, the supreme soul, and therefore he is also infinity. Energy concentrated to infinity. And because it is concentrated to infinity, it can never be destroyed. Something that is infinite, it is not mortal. It becomes immortal. And so the understanding of God is basically that, a being of light, like the soul, energy concentrated to infinity. There is no physical form. And God is considered an entity that is available to heal the human spirit. There are many explanations given to prove the existence or non-existence of God in many traditions. For example, there has to be someone to have created this intelligent world, many things like that. We don't go into that in the philosophy of Raja Yoga. We look at God as a healer, as a living, conscient energy, as a being that is available forever for the human souls. When the human soul has become burdened with a lot of experiences, we need the experience of that selfless love to heal the soul. And so, in the process of meditation, we go into the experience of being that eternal consciousness, the soul, and go beyond and connect to that eternal consciousness that is God, who is a being of light. And you stay in that companionship for as long as you can. And then you get back to whatever you need to do in the world. That's the understanding. Does that answer your question? Yes. Anything else you would like to ask? And actually, it's interesting, because if you look at many religions that speak about God, the original understanding of God is light. In fact, if you look at the symbol of the Supreme across religions, it's startlingly similar. In Christianity, you have all these candles in the church, symbolizing the flame, light. Because how do you didn't have light like this before. The only way you could symbolize energy and light was through a flame. And in the old churches, you have the sanctuary lamp, a long red container with a flame inside, supposed to be always lit, symbolizing the eternal flame, the eternal light, God. If you go to Islam, the Muslims turn to the Kaaba when they pray. You know what is there on the Kaaba? No. This room with the cloth, you know that? Where Muslims turn to when they pray. It's in Mecca. It's in that mosque in Mecca. On the wall of the Kaaba, there is a stone. And the stone is shaped exactly like a flame. Stone symbolizing eternity. Flame symbolizing light, the eternal flame. Ancient Hindu temples, there is no physical form of a god or a goddess. What you have is something called the Shivalinga. It is also an oval-shaped form, symbolizing stone. Stone in the form of an oval flame, eternal light. So it's not something very new. It's an understanding that ancient religions have had. And then with time, we have given it different forms. So we try and return to that original understanding of the Supreme as the eternal light and the healer and connect to that in the experience of meditation. Okay? I think Sonia has something to say. Yes? You would like to wind up with some meditation, but
yeah.
You want to say something?
Thank you very much, Susanna. Before we go into meditation, I just thought I mentioned next talk will be opening your heart and respect life in connection with environment. And we have a little leaflet here, and on the back of it you have a written meditation. A meditation for the environment. And we will finish this series of talks with a meditation outdoors. Did you see it on the mail? We'll gather together på Islands Brygge. And we hired a big green lawn so we can sit together and spread good vibes. And we have ordered a good weather that day. because there is no plan B if it rains. So if it rains, you have to bring your raincoat. But I hope we can sort of celebrate together in a sense that day. It's also the 1st of June, a nice day of starting the summer. So thank you very much.